And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Yeah, this is Phil Lernis, and in Motown, that's Dean Haglund. He's on Earwatch, and I'm on iWatch, because, what, you're posting the ears of your dog?
Yes, the Doberman's, the ears don't naturally stay up, so you have to take them up. As the puppy grows older, the cartilage hardens, and then, so you have to make sure it doesn't tear the tape off. So I'm on Earwatch, puppy Earwatch.
And I'm on iWatch because I can't see a thing. And yeah. It's really bad. I mean, it's awful. I was able to get an assignment done this week because my goddaughter showed me how I could invert colors on the laptop. So I could do a document as white writing on black background, which I can see fine.
There you go.
But black on white is just white. And
right.
I don't mean that as a political statement in any way, shape, or form. What do you get when you mix black with white? You get white. I don't mean that. I just, for whatever reason, I need the inversion of the colors because of these cataracts. Now, you just asked a question, what happened when I get cataracts again in 30 years? First of all, maybe we miss a week of the podcast when that happens. But secondly, can I get cataracts on phony lenses?
Well, so you're getting plastic discs stuck into your eyeball.
So the entire lens is being removed from my eyes, from both eyes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then you're getting like an engineered glass or plastic thing stuck in there.
Yeah.
And then
into the eyeball. Yeah.
But you know, I have, some plexiglass bottles. And they get a little cloudy over the years through the UV and stuff like that. I would think that maybe your plastic lens might have some similar erosion over time. Did they give you a guarantee of how long the new fake lens is going to last?
No, I don't know. I'll ask that. I'm meeting with the surgeon on Friday, so I'll ask that very question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if it's plastic, then what about, you've been known to go to the Arizona desert, 120 degree heat, won't your eyeballs melt?
In 120 degrees?
Well, I don't know the melt ratio of what this plastic is. I mean, so let's say it's made from the heat shield of the space shuttle.
I think my migraines generate more heat than that. But anyway, the point is, Dean, thanks to all the people who heard that we did a podcast where I talked about why I'm blind and decided to, instead of listening to that, write me fucking emails asking me questions about it. Because sure, I can read emails. No, I can't.
And then you get to like, hey, I read your email.
I read your blind. Sorry, man. Hey, can you let me know? Anyway, so, hey, you know, no sooner had we recorded last week's show than someone we talked about died.
So, right. Who was that?
Let's get started in the Chill Pack morgue, shall we?
Shall we?
celebrity deaths.
So John Singleton dies of complications following a stroke at age 51. When we spoke last week, he was in a coma. And by the time I was ready to post the show, he had died. And there wasn't a damn thing I could do about it.
Well, yeah, it sounds like there's very little anybody can do about these strokes that lead to such complications.
Terrifying. So Luke Perry, then John Singleton. I mean, this we're going to have a presentation. I think I told you this at the Breakfast Club some point soon on stroke and you know, signs, early signs and warning signs of strokes. And these questions about
strokes at 50.
Yeah. You know, my sister was in her early 50s when she had a stroke, so I'm suddenly very grateful that that she pulled through and that it didn't get worse and worse following it. Although I have heard, but this is not from a genuine medical authority, it's from Lily, and as I explained last week, just because she plays doctors, nurses, and patients on a weekly basis as a care actor, it does not actually give her a medical degree. So,
what?
But she said that it is profoundly more dangerous for men than women.
Really?
Strokes. Yeah. So,
damn it.
There you go. We because it's harder being a man.
Wow. There's our call out this week.
Hey,
of course you're saying this now because you can't read emails. So yeah, of course you're going to say everything is completely inflammatory.
It's harder being a 50-year-old man than it is to be Lily Holloman. Okay. You know, Lil got a gig for the summer, so we'll step back into the morgue. Let's step out into the hallway just for a minute.
We'll step back into the morgue for a little chat.
Yeah, have a little bite to eat and a smoke while we wait to do an autopsy on Oscar-nominated director John Singleton. So we won't be coming and making a visit to your X-Fest outside Chicago there.
Oh. In Schaumburg in June, first week of June.
A couple reasons. One,
you're blind.
Yeah, but all have undergone the surgeries then. We're still going to go to the East Coast, still going to go to Washington, D.C. But it would have to be such a quick trip that it doesn't really warrant it. Plus, I'd rather honestly go to the Knoxville convention
in August.
That's going to be
fun. I would like that too.
And we want to visit our friends, the Terenzios. And again, a quick visit isn't good enough. So, and it has to be a quick visit because Lily booked an immersive theater gig.
Oh,
during the summer.
I like this.
Yes.
Immersive theater stuff.
So I guess it didn't start with Sleep No More, but obviously Sleep No More really elevated immersive theater into the popular theater-going consciousness in a way that it had not been before. And so she gets to do an immersive theater experience. It obviously includes her interest in that. It gets to include improv. You know, I don't think I mentioned this, but she's on a permanent house improv team at one of the improv theaters in Los Angeles.
I did not know this.
At the PAC, in Hollywood. And so it gets to include that and her lifelong love of Alice in Wonderland because it is an immersive Mad Hatter Tea Party. Theatrical
experience.
Very psychedelic, apparently, with liquor. So,
whoa,
yeah. So,
Where's that going to take
in
place?
Hollywood today at an undisclosed locale?
Wow,
she will be playing the Dormouse and the Cheshire Cat.
Wow,
and there's
fantastic
reason to believe that she may. I don't know. I can't get her. I can't pin her down on this, but she may be playing Christopher Walken playing the Cheshire Cat.
Hilarious.
So anyway, so
that's going to be fantastic.
That is going to be fantastic. That's
and great. That runs the whole summer.
Yeah, until August, until sometime in August. So I'm thinking we can time it out, make it to Knoxville for your convention and see Uncle Harry and
Uncle Harry. I want the tour.
Yeah, exactly. And explore. And then go visit our friends, the Terenzios in Chicago. So that would be the plan. All right. Are you ready to step back into the Chill Pack morgue with me?
Yes, let's do that one more time.
John Singleton. Oh, yeah, one more time. I guess every time we open the doors, we need to hear...
Celebrity deaths.
I don't know. Hello.
Thank you, Garrett Wadley. John Singleton wrote and directed Boys in the Hood in 1991, the groundbreaking urban drama film starring Ice Cube, Cuba Gooding Jr., as young men negotiating gang culture. I don't even know if I wrote the word negotiating. That seems like an odd word choice, but let's go with it because I can barely see what I wrote. but they navigated, maybe navigated is what I wrote. They navigated gang culture there in South Central Los Angeles. Great film. We've talked about it. He was nominated, Singleton was, for the Academy Award for Best Director for Boys in the Hood, becoming not only the youngest directorial nominee in history, but, and I don't know if we mentioned this, at age 24, he became the first African-American nominee in that category.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a surprise.
Isn't that, what is it? I mean.
Well, I guess.
I mean, I guess you would think it's surprising in retrospect that Spike Lee wasn't nominated for Do the Right Thing.
Right.
But
yeah, that's what I would assume.
But I defy you to quickly, off the top of your head, name another African American who should have been nominated for Best Director prior to that.
Mario Peebles.
wait, the father or the son? So the father for Sweetbacks. But isn't that Melvin Van Peebles or Mario Van Peebles for what? For Solo or I don't know what Renegades. I forget all the names of the movies he made. But anyway.
Yeah, so did I.
All right.
Okay.
So there we go. He went on to direct such films John Singleton did as Rosewood in 97, Shaft in 2000, Baby Boy 2001, and Too Fast, Too Furious in 2003. Directed the... I mean, you know that the guy's bio, like he started at the top and kind of tapered off when included very near the beginning of his bio is a music video he directed. He was a producer of some of his own films, as well as some other director's films, including Hustle and Flow, which did make quite an impact, and Black Snake Moan, which I was kind of fond of back in 2006. He co-created and produced the FX TV drama series Snowfall, which I never saw.
I never saw that either. What was that about?
I don't know. I never saw it, and I certainly can't see it now.
All TV watching is on
I don't
hiatus.
Feel like we're giving the dramatic heft to John Singleton's death that we should, but well, I don't know what else we're supposed to say.
Every time you mention something about I can't see it, then we're off on a tangent on your eye surgery again.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I really can't see very well. It was a rough day, though, I will say this. John Singleton, who really meant so much to so many, if only because of Boys in the Hood. And I'm not saying that's the only reason, but that alone
is a big deal.
Yeah, would have made it a real loss for a lot of people. And it was the same day that federal judge Damon Keith, who was a seminal figure both in the judiciary and in the long, arduous journey towards hopefully racial equality in this country, that he died following a long and prolific career serving on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, where he served for more than 40 years. Presiding over courts in Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and Tennessee. He never retired, serving until his death at age 96.
Wow.
he was mentored, I believe, by Thurgood Marshall, and his most notable decision was in a 1971 case regarding the Nixon administration. Nixon's Justice Department was wiretapping people suspected of conspiring to bomb a CIA office, and they were doing it, the wiretapping, without court orders.
Ah, ha, ha.
And Keith ordered them to cease wiretapping without warrants. The Justice Department appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which upheld Keith's decision unanimously.
Hey.
He was also known for a 1971 order to desegregate schools in Pontiac, Michigan via busing, as well as for upholding the affirmative action policy in the Detroit Police Department.
Wow, look at that. That's my neighborhood.
Yes, and that indeed is where Judge Keith lived and died at the age of 96. So, you know, a seminal figure, and also just the story, one of these stories that's so inspiring. He was born to a poor family in Detroit. And so, you know, stayed there all his life and made a name for himself and was an important pillar architecturally of our society while there. And I think that's, again, certainly inspiring.
Yeah, for sure.
He worked his way through college by waiting tables and by cleaning the college president's home and cleaning the chapel. He was drafted into the U.S. Army during World War II and served in a time of military segregation, working in an all-black unit assigned to kitchen duties. After the war, he attended law school at the historically black Howard University. He found notable mentors, in Supreme Court Judge, future at that point, Supreme Court Judge Thurgood Marshall and William Hastie, who would become the U.S.'s first black federal judge. He founded one of Detroit's first black law firms, Damon Keith did. So he, it goes on and on. But you understand why I say, wow, that's a really sad day. You know, somebody who is this beacon in so many ways of overcoming every odd imaginable to wield a significant authority. And I heard the story, and maybe this is apocryphal, but he took great pride in the fact that he never had to find anyone who appeared before him during all those decades in contempt of his courtroom.
And he
attributed it to the fact that he treated everybody with kindness and respect.
And that's nice.
Yeah, as a judge. And that, you know, instead of demanding and expecting the respect, he gave it and received it in return.
That's how you get it.
So, Damon Keith, 96. And now a man who, a performer, a beloved performer, Dean, who I think it's safe to say never bit off more than he could chew, Baca.
Oh, wow.
At 74, of all the things that I can't read, I could read that joke.
Yeah, really?
Peter Mayhew.
Yes, Peter Mayhew.
Did you ever meet him at any of the conventions?
Did I? Yeah. We would hang out backstage at numerous conventions, the last being Melbourne in 2016, I'm going to say. And he taught me the Tim Tam Slam with not coffee, but port wine, that fella. So
I don't know of it with coffee or with wine. What explain this, please?
Well,
is it a Wookiee? It's a Wookiee tradition, is it?
No. He's very much not. He's very much out of character. Very few Wookiee jokes he actually pertains to. However, he did love Australia, and it was there at numerous conventions.
But you're going to explain to me what Tub Tim Siam is.
No, I haven't got to explain. Australia has a beloved cookie. The cookie is called the Tim Tam, spelled T-I-M-T-A-M. It is two cookie wafers with like an Oreo filling. It's kind of a square Oreo, if you will, except not vanilla. Often is chocolate or a variety of flavors. Okay?
So are you saying, are you telling me that this story involves how the Wookiee savors cookie wafers?
Indeed. I said to Peter, hey, what's going on? How are you? Just moved here. And he goes, oh, you know, the Tim Tam Slam. And his assistant went and got a bottle of port. Poured us a glass of wine. This is in the green room, not in front of the signing members of the audience, of course. And then what you do is you bite off one corner of the Tim Tam, because it is rectangular, and then you bite off the exact opposite corner on the other end, so that you have basically a diagonal line. And then when you suck hot coffee through it, the chocolate filling melts, and you have like a delicious mocha cookie straw, as it were. However, that also works with port wine. And so you can sort of shotgun a delicious port through a Tim Tam cookie and get sugared up and loaded at the same time. So he introduced me to that concept, and boy, did we enjoy that convention.
Okay.
That's my Peter May. He's a great guy.
That's a good one. Now, so let me test you on your knowledge, because I'm sure that, you know, this is a pretty famous story, but how did he get the role of Chewbacca?
Ah, he has told that story, and I forget all the details.
I mean, George Lucas was, you know, they were filming there outside London, and he needed a tall actor to play the part, and they went out searching, and they found 7'2" Peter Mayhew, who was a part-time actor, but he was working when they found him as an orderly at a hospital in London.
No, I did not actually know that part of the story.
So he plays it in, obviously, the original three films, plays it again in Revenge of the Sith, and in 2015, Star Wars The Force Awakens. He did not provide the voice of Chewbacca, obviously, but fans credit his kind eyes and his body language for giving the character heart and soul, and that's no small thing. I mean, it truly is. He did embody a real character in that.
Yes, for sure.
And it's one of the reasons why you're glad that, you know, it wasn't originally made at a time where they thought, let's CGI that character.
Well, exactly. And when you think of the dwarf in Lord of the Rings, and it's John Rhys-Davies, who's, you know, my height, but you can reduce them digitally all over the place.
Or through forced perspective, which is how they did it a lot in that first film. And then I feel like they didn't thereafter. But anyway.
Yeah, but you're right. You digitally alter in After Effects. You can change heights and hand sizes and all sorts of things. Whereas in 1977, you didn't have that option. So,
And thank goodness. So he really was allowed to embody a character. You know, that you needed the person in the suit to do the work. I remember how charming he is in our friend Chase Masterson and James Kerwin's Yesterday Was a Lie?
That's right. I forgot he was in that, actually.
So if you'd like to see your beloved Chewbacca, Peter Mayhew, in a very interesting... of all the black and white sci-fi musical film noirs from the last 20 years, this is one of them. It's Yesterday Was a Lie. And Peter Mayhew had a key supporting role in that film.
All right.
Okay. Finally, one of these character actors from, again, my youth, from the years where I fell in love with movies and really came of age, who made such an indelible impact on my memory, an indelible mark on my memory. And so it was very sad to see that Larry Flash Jenkins had died at 63 years of age. I probably first became quite fond of him because I was a big fan of the TV series The White Shadow.
Oh, right.
Having had aims, as I did, to someday come to UCLA to play on the basketball team. So,
how did that work out?
It didn't work well, but every time I saw Ken Howard at in the SAG-AFTRA offices when he was serving as president, I made him tutor me a little bit on the box and one defense. So,
wow. Good on you.
Yeah, that was pretty good off the top of my head, actually. Right. So he played Wardell Stone, you know, one of the students on the team there. But one of these guys that would show up in, again, like I said, indelible roles, bit roles in some of the most pleasing movies of the 80s. I'm thinking Mr. Mom. I'm thinking Body Double. But especially Fletch, which I love. To this day, I love. Because it really works as a mystery. That's the thing. You know, Chevy Chase, I'm one of those people who really did find Chevy Chase very funny. Uh-huh. But it's the Chevy Chase movie that works for people who don't like Chevy Chase because structurally, it's really good. You know, they took the mystery from that novel and really Michael Ritchie adapted it very, very well. And and it's filled with super interesting character actors like Emmett Walsh and Larry Flash Jenkins and Richard Libertini and a young Gina Davis. I mean, it's a really, really good cast. And Larry Jenkins played a Gummy, the drug addict who is an informant living there on the beach. Also, who can forget him in Ferris Bueller's Day Off as the valet parking attendant who goes all co-pilot on a joyride with the sports car that Ferris pulls up in.
Fantastic.
So many movies. And he went on to become a filmmaker himself, formed his own production company, made independent films, produced, wrote, directed, acted. So Larry Flash Jenkins, 63 years of age. All right. So I've done a little bit of digging, Dean, to find out a little more about where we're at with the Writers Guild and the agents.
Yes, tell me. I've been on pins and needles on this one.
Because, you know, there's some, what do you call it? There's some, not animosity, but displeasure within the ranks at the Writers Guild about what's going on, though no one seems to dispute the fundamental issues that the Writers Guild is tackling. Namely, as we've discussed before, the serious conflict of interest embedded in the agency system right now.
Right.
Namely, the often abused practice of packaging, as well as agencies actually going one step further and producing.
Well, this is it. Yeah, the production arm.
But it's both. And we didn't really talk about the packaging because packaging has gone on so well, but for so long. But this would mean, you want Dean Haglund for this convention. Well, it will cost you this much, but it can cost you less than that if you take Phil Lernis as well.
Right.
And suddenly you're making less so that I can make some, but most importantly, so that the agency representing us is making more because they get the cut from both of us. And the more items you package, the more fees they get. But it all might be predicated on having one element that they really want. So if these are the terms to get the one element that they want, well, that one element may not be commanding as much money as he or she or it could, right?
Right.
So packaging is a problem. But
the Writers Guild, this goes across the board then. This is also Directors Guild and Screen Actors Guild then.
It could be, yeah. But as we know, the Screen Actors Guild threw in with agents over managers all those years ago. And so it's really hard to unring that bell until whatever agreement they have in place comes up. And this is how labor negotiations happen in this town, right? One union takes the lead on it. And then when the issue comes up, and that's why it's so
important. There's precedent.
There's precedent.
Yeah.
And there will be more pressure down the line on these agents in this case. Or if the negotiations are with producers, right, then there's more pressure down the line. So, but then there is the producing element, which we've talked about as well. And that's basically how can your employer on the production side also be the one representing you in negotiations with your interest in mind? How is that possible?
Right.
And so nobody's denying those points. And then also, as we talked about before, the code of conduct, the need for transparency, the need for basic rules of conduct in terms of negotiating, in terms of contracts, that all agents have to follow. And so, but I think a lot of writers never expected that they were going to be sending an file form notifying their agents that they'd been fired. So I think, you know, so there's but the underlying issues, you know, nobody has a problem with. So the real question is, you know, where do we go? Right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And
now it's hard to go back. A lot of, and also writers have been with their agents for years, sometimes decades, and to then go up and fire them as a negotiating ploy, and then to go back to that guy going, hey, man, that was just my union telling me what to do. Well, that's now jeopardized a relationship.
Well, I think that's why they did this e-file form that came as written by the guild, so that it wasn't personal, it was pro forma. And I think that's why. Now, whether that works to ameliorate any hard feelings, you know, I don't know. But it also, we got to remember, it doesn't affect any shows already on the air. It's only affecting new work.
Oh.
Moving forward. Yeah. Negotiating new work.
Well, still.
Because those contracts are already in place. But I thought it was really interesting that, you know, the Writers Guild, and I, you know, say what you will, but this is a different, point of view than most, the labor unions have had. And I think in a time of conglomerates and ever-changing, you know, financial realities, you have to think, differently. But they think that negotiating is not something that bargaining is the only way to negotiate is not only false, it's counterproductive.
Right.
That there's no benefit in just talking if there truly is an impasse. So bargaining has to therefore take place both at the table in formal sessions and away from the table through whatever pressure can be applied.
Yes, and when you have very little pressure points, I mean, other than the talent of the writer, you have few bargaining chips other than you're fired or not fired.
Exactly,
really.
Exactly. Especially when it's not about negotiating percentages. If you want to change their code of conduct, you're basically saying, no, we want to write a whole new game in this.
Right.
We're not going to try to fix problems to a system that fundamentally is flawed. We want a new system. And so it's actually, to me, kind of exciting because it really does offer the opportunity to create what we're so often disappointed that unions don't, which is a new way of doing business that actually reflects the reality of how much the industry has changed.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Talk about Wild West all of a sudden. It's a whole new system of how, but even, you know, the consumers taste, how we watch TV is being manipulated so much by binge watching and Netflix's countdown to trailers, all of that. You have to have a whole new contract that reflects how that is going to pay out.
This week on Saturday night was the closing night of one of the great bars of Los Angeles, the Good Luck Bar in Los Feliz, just around the corner from the Vista Theater. That building is coming down in favor of a boutique hotel because that's what's needed. There's a little hope that the Good Luck might end up being part of it because the Los Feliz Neighborhood Council responded to a petition to to say shame on you, developer, more or less is what they did, because it's meaningless. They can't block it, but they could denounce it, and that's what they did. And for the first time since 2017, the developer and the owner of the Good Luck Bar are actually speaking now about making that bar be a part of the hotel, which would be nice, because it would be cool if certain things that make a neighborhood great are allowed to stay in the neighborhood after everybody has moved there. You know, like they're the reason people want to live there. And then,
I got to think that's changing, though. I mean, people realize in the new urbanization that going in, putting something in changes its ecostructure.
I guess, but the owners of these buildings just want money. They just want to take advantage of how desirable the property is. So this is what's happening. Really popular up and down the boulevards in the main hearts of Los Feliz. Like, we had a really, really successful vinyl record store here. Because vinyl is really popular. And the owner just, you know, raised their rent by a factor of 10 to get them out, because what they wanted to be able to do is just to sell it to developers to make condos out of it, because they can only take advantage of the property value for so long. And then they're going to go and, you know, be able to put their kids and their grandkids and their great grandkids through college or whatever. And then President Elizabeth Warren's going to make college free. So in your face, developers. But anyway, the reason I brought this up was no sooner do I get home from Last Call on its last night.
Right.
Then my phone says, how was the Good Luck Bar?
What?
Yeah, like AI knows everywhere I am. I mean, how did it know that I was inside the Good Luck Bar versus outside? It's a tiny little bar. But it knew.
Well, you tweeted a picture on your
Facebook. No, not till later that night when I was home.
Oh.
Yeah, on the way home, you know, Lady Google says, how was the Good Luck Bar? And so this, I brought this up because of what you were saying about how we watch what we watch.
Right.
So it knows, technology knows everything we're doing. AI knows everything we're doing.
Well, because the microphone's always on your iPhone.
And keeps,
that's the other thing.
But therefore, we keep getting forced into certain directions, or urged or encouraged into certain directions. That was just apropos of what you were saying about how we watch, how we come to the things that we watch has changed so dramatically, right?
Right. Exactly.
So it is scary, and it
Well, that's why I always go to my Netflix and I watch something super obscure and odd, based on a search of something I'm thinking of.
Yeah, I mean, I try to do it through ratings. Like, based on your love of this, we recommend this. And then I go through and I rate all those things they recommend 1 star.
Oh.
But I don't know.
I just watched today the Indian Bollywood biopic of the great artist Raja Ravi Rama and his trials and tribulations of making the gods and goddesses in his paintings immoral, unrighteous, and obscene.
I'm interested in how Avengers Endgame AIDS. No, AIDS the summer. If it does, right? Did the movies that got their trailers on before Avengers Endgame, do they see a bump?
Ew, interesting.
Because remember, it always was that most people decided what movies to see based on the trailers. And So you've got a movie that is getting people in droves, and once people go to a theater and have a good time, they tend to want to go to the theater again. So are they selecting the movies that played in advance? Now, this weekend was not a good one at the box office for any movie not named Avengers. And it wasn't because it took all the air out of the room. I mean, it did only, 40% of what it had done the weekend before. I say only. I mean, it still was, it was the second biggest second weekend of all time. So, it did fine. I don't mean that it's failing. But the point is that there was still plenty of room for other movies to do well, and none of them did. Now, maybe those were the movies. Probably those were the movies. And quite probably those weren't movies who had trailers before Avengers Endgame. So that's why I'm interested. How will these films perform? And I wonder if there's any way to, track that. But I bet I could find something, right? But I'm interested because, we keep thinking, okay, how are we going to keep getting people to the theaters? Well, people want to go to the theaters, as evidenced by Marvel Avengers Endgame, as we talked about last week. And this movie, as of now, ranks 7th all-time domestically, just ahead of the first Avengers. It's the number 2 film internationally already worldwide, and it's going to pass. If it hasn't already, it's going to pass Force Awakens and Titanic to become the second biggest hit of all time. Worldwide. It's already the number 2 internationally, but when you combine domestic and international this week, it'll certainly be number 2 all time. But
wow.
But does it, in the parlance of politics, does it have coattails?
And the question is, we won't know.
Well, that's the question. The answer is we don't know. We won't know for a little while, but it will be interesting to look at how box office performs this summer as a result, and also the first summer without widespread movie subscription services, which really helped boost box office last year.
Right.
So we'll see. Did you catch up with the David Lynch, The Art Life documentary?
No, I still haven't found that in all my filterings.
What do you mean you still haven't found it? It's available on disc on Netflix, but you don't do discs off Netflix. And
I don't get they don't do, they
and don't. And streaming online through the Criterion collection, but
right. But I don't have the Criterion collection on my Roku.
So David Lynch, The Art Life, Dean Haglund. I really wanted to find out. I wanted to lock horns with you about this and about this guy. First of all, I wanted you to be able to know for yourself that his college roommate was Peter Wolf from the Jay Giles Band.
No.
Yeah, how great is that? That was his freshman year college roommate in Boston. And until they went to see a concert, a Bob Dylan concert. This is in the 60s. And they go to see a Bob Dylan concert, and David Lynch has kind of shitty seats, and he's really struck by just really how tiny Bob Dylan is. He's a tiny little man wearing tiny little jeans, holding a tiny little guitar, and it's not doing it for him. So he leaves, and Peter Wolf comes back to the apartment later and says, how dare you walk out on Bob Dylan? Nobody walks out on Bob Dylan. And David Lynch says, well, I do, so you're fucking out of this apartment for good.
Wow.
And that was, so they stopped rooming together. Yeah. But Peter Wolf was responsible for David Lynch discovering marijuana. That's a fun story. So there's good things. But it really is intriguing because, like I've told you, it's not about his movies. It is about his art. It's about how much painting and sculpture, but painting especially means to him, and that that's how he comes to filmmaking, because of his desire to, you know, the lightning bolt hits him. He wants to make a moving painting.
Wow.
You know, a motion painting. And
yeah.
And he gets a grant from the American Film Institute that allows him to make, he makes one short film, he gets a grant that allows him to make a second film. And that's before he comes to the conservatory, AFI, here in Los Angeles, which at that time was at Greystone Manor, the Beverly Hills mansion. And,
oh, right.
So it's before that, they give him, when he's there in Pittsburgh, they give him the opportunity to make one of these films. And then they invite him to the AFI workshop out here. And he's there for 4 years living in the barns, the old carriage houses at the Greystone Estate, where he builds himself all the sets for Eraserhead. And of course, Eraserhead's the movie that you like and of his. And it is a moving painting.
And, right. Yeah, absolutely.
And it reflects, it's so amazing, because this is where the insight comes into his films, is because he talks about his upbringing, he talks about his childhood, he talks about high school, he talks about how he's kind of split between the personalities that he would present to the world, whether he was working as an artist or at home or at school. And you get from that information that offers insight into his movies in a way that you would never get from him if he was talking about the movies, because he won't offer up anything insightful about his movies. But
right.
It's so clear that, like, his relationship to Philadelphia, where he goes to art school, is where Eraserhead's born, because the city itself terrifies him. He just utterly abhors everything about it. There's one great story in particular where he's going to the corner shop and he passes this woman who's there, sitting on a bench with her kid. And he looks at her and he says, "How you doing?" And she immediately responds, "How you doing? How you doing? How you doing?" Then looks at her kid and says, "If you grow up to be like that guy, I will fucking kill you."
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow, that's Philadelphia, brother love.
Yeah, and so, but he at the same time says it's exactly where he needed to be to inspire so much art. You know, he was so productive because he needed the inspiration, something to push off against. So I think there is so much in it that, I think will prove meaningful to you, if only I could get you to watch it.
Well, yes, now I'm going to... find it somehow. David Lynch, The Art Life. That's what I got to find.
Yeah, a 2016 documentary available, Criterion Collection. And
Well, and it might be included with my, I just did a search, with my Amazon Prime subscription.
Oh, wouldn't that be something?
Wouldn't that be something?
So you didn't look so hard then, is what you're...
Well, no, I have a puppy Doberman that is really eating up a lot of focus, I got to say. So.
Oh, my God, you... Lilu has been on the scene all of, like, a month and a half, and Lilu's already been thrown under the bus in a way that it took Mila and Akasha years before they were blamed for stuff.
Well, and rightly so, because... puppy Doberman is required. It's a much larger handful. You really have to guide a Doberman in its early days so that when it quickly gets to 65 pounds, it's not knocking over neighbors and murdering plants. So, yeah, we are full hands-on right now with the upbringing of a well-socialized and polite Doberman.
But keeping it back with the Marvel Universe, how is Loki doing?
Yeah, Loki is fantastic. We're just down here hanging out in the sunshine, enjoys its own loft on the third floor of our facility here, and is, like you said, quite the cuddle monster. Fortunately, it's nocturnal, so that 3 a.m. purring on your head and back Well, welcome is a 3 a.m. wake-up call, but, you know.
Yeah, no, this is why I told you it's really smart when a cat's young to give them their own room.
Yeah.
And enclose them in that room.
Yeah.
Because the day will come where they'll shift their patterning enough to cohabitate with you at night. But not,
so that shift is happening.
But, well, it's going to be, it'll be a good 5 or 6 years before it happens for good.
Oh,
but yeah, no, the thing is that if you don't give her own place and enclose them, don't give them access to you, I mean, you will never get a good night's sleep ever again. And
no.
you'll go insane. Back to the Avengers then. I haven't seen the Endgame. Are you going to see the Endgame?
Yeah, I'm planning on it. It's playing just walking distance from our place here in Birmingham, Michigan. So could be more excited to go to this 1926 historic theater that's been on our radar of things to do ever since we moved here.
And, you know, I mean, I want to, and I have no doubt that it probably is a very good movie. You know, I really, really hated Infinity War. And I hated because it was just, I mean, I hated it in the same way that I hated Harry Potter 7 Part 1, you know? the whole reason we're doing this is to squeeze every last dollar we can out of the finale.
Right, right. It's a series of trailers setting up something that
exactly.
We're already planning. Yeah,
exactly. Oh, but everybody says, oh, but Phil, it was the ultimate cliffhanger. What was that? Well, I mean, half of everybody got killed. That's the ultimate cliffhanger. Yeah, you know what? You could have established that in a pre-title teaser sequence.
Totally.
In this movie.
I know, right?
This movie is 3 hours long, Endgame. I don't know. Spend 10 minutes before the opening credits giving us what we needed, which was a snap of the fucking fingers and half of all characters. It's like with the, remember Titanic, although, you know, I know people love the love story and everything, but Titanic for me would have been a much tighter, much better movie if they had just done a montage of the beginning of all the characters on board saying it's unsinkable and then cut to iceberg dead ahead and then take the movie from there and it would have been fine. But it's just a cynical, craven cash grab where we're going to spend hours murdering these characters that you like so that you'll come back and pay money again to see how we get out from underneath that.
And this is Marvel's operandi forever. I mean, it's always been. They've been very much money-focused, more than DC comics over the years, I think. And so it's just a extension into a new medium for them of the same battle plan.
And here's where I am intrigued, and I want to see how they pull this out from a cultural impact level. There is an opportunity in Thanos, his story, Infinity War, which is this idea that he expresses that humankind is not to be valued or trusted as stewards of anything anyway. That we literally have allowed the population of this planet to become twice of what this planet can support.
Right.
So why not? Why, you know, Thanos figures. Why not just snap the fingers? And so there's an opportunity, and I'm intrigued as to whether there's anything that addresses this at all in Endgame, and maybe there is, and that'd be cool. But what about that possible subtext of climate change, of famine, of disease, of the things that are linked so closely to overpopulation and overcrowding on this planet?
Well, and that's become a reasonable motivation on a lot of you. You think of Kingsman, the bad guy played by, I forget.
Right.
You know.
But so my point is, in Endgame, do they not only reveal a clever way to undo the damage that's done by Thanos, but to heal the damage that's done by humanity itself?
Wow.
Wouldn't that be interesting? There's a historic, unique opportunity here because some of us are really bored and really disturbed by, again, the perpetual nature of building and feeding a movie infrastructure, a pop culture infrastructure that is all about encouraging banal, childish fantasies. This right. idea of the world's greatest heroes. And why are they the world's greatest heroes? Oh, because they guard us against alien attack. The things that threaten us are within. They are not coming from outer space. Can we have stories that allude to those things, if metaphorically? And,
right.
And I'm not saying Endgame doesn't. Maybe it does. That's why I'm intrigued. So maybe it'll do it. You know, you and I talked about how when I saw that Laurel and Hardy movie over the holidays, how one of the bonus things on the disc was early television commercials from the late 40s for toys, for children's toys. And all the toys being advertised on TV for kids there in the late 40s were toys that expressed to children how great it is to grow up and become an adult.
Right. Yes, we were talking about that. The Easy Bake Oven,
right.
as it were.
Your briefcase. A boy's first briefcase. You know, so many things about being an adult, how great being an adult is. That's the message.
Right.
And now, all we have is a culture that manufactures things that we're selling to adults to tell them, oh, boy, living in childish fantasy is great, isn't it?
Well, and reliving your childhood is lucrative, even.
So it's really dangerous. It's and look at where we've ended up. It's two movies that I saw this week. I thought about this a lot. On I caught two films of varying success from 2018. One was a big hit called Rampage. And it starred The Rock, Dwayne Johnson. And I wanted to watch a Dwayne Johnson movie because he's the highest paid movie actor on the planet. He's the biggest box office draw on the planet. So I saw this movie, Rampage. And this, I don't know, this is basically, you know, it's giant gorilla, giant wolf, giant sea creature, destroy everything. And only Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Moneypenny from the Bond films can stop them. Okay. You know, to talk seriously about this film is kind of a waste of time. But what really struck me was this is exactly the kind of movie that I used to do behind-the-scenes making-of documentaries for when I worked for New Image.
Oh, no.
17 years ago. These movies that would literally get made because a Japanese buyer would say, giant spider, kill car. That's what they wanted to see. I'll give you this amount of money if a giant spider kills a car. And these are the movies that used to get made, what we would way back in the day call B pictures, but they were made for foreign only sale. They were low budget. They were independent movies. This is what would get made to fill that need. But those are the movies that are getting all the money and resources now being made.
Right.
And who are the kind of people that know how to make them? The people that came up through the New Images of the world. Indeed, the new Hellboy movie, for crying out loud, is a New Image movie.
It is?
Yeah, it's Avi Lerner's production company.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
So it's crazy. Like, all the money and the resources in movies have gone to what used to be the movies that they wouldn't even bother to release in this country because they were so meaningless and so disposable.
Well, yeah, but now we've rendered meaning secondary to everything else. I mean, I think also what you see is the practice, New Image, putting out product under budget, inexpensively, now becomes quite attractive even the major studios, where costs are now more a bigger concern than the quality or the prestige. You don't see many prestige films come out anymore. You don't even hear that term, really.
There's a great scene. I might have to excerpt the audio from it, from The Player. Back in, what was that, 1992? Is that when The Player came out? Robert Altman's The Player?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Peter Gallagher plays a rival studio executive, you know, same studio as Tim Robbins' character, but yeah. He's a rival within the studio. And he gives this great speech about how we're paying these writers way too much money. You know, give me the newspaper, just read me some headlines and I'll write you write you a bunch of films. And it's all about what would truly become the nature of it, where every studio movie has to be a high concept movie.
Right. Yeah. You can do that. But yeah, you see that scene, you go, hey, that guy's really good.
Yeah, it makes sense. And that's what's scary about it, right?
Yeah, right.
Because storytelling's hard, but making concepts into product is not hard. And it's expensive, though. And that's the irony, again, is that, as I love pointing out, the profit margin of the film industry is no different now than it was back in the 1970s.
The profit margin.
Yeah, the margin's the same. It's just the numbers are so much bigger because of inflation and things like this.
Right.
And that profit is being generated by fewer and fewer titles. Because more and more of the percentage of the resources are going towards those titles. But in a corporate conglomerate culture, as you always say, you need a product locomotive.
Yep.
Because the bottom line is not the bottom line.
No, right? The bottom line is not the bottom line. It's, it's ancillary. Ancillary. Is your name.
The other movie that I saw, and then we're wrapping out year 12. This is the final show of year 12 of
Chill
Pack Hollywood Hour. But I caught, I watched The Spy Who Dumped Me.
Uh-huh.
And do you remember this? This starred Mila Kunis and Kate McKinnon from Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Gillian Anderson has a supporting role in it, and Justin Theroux. And I wanted to see this because, again, there's so few comedies. Here's a high concept comedy. You know, I've heard that broad comedy is out, and I don't mean broads as in women. I mean, as in, you know, the certain kind of comedy. But here's not only a comedy, albeit high concept, but one that stars women and one that's written and directed by a woman, Susanna Fogel. So I wanted to see it. And, it is, again, such a disheartening trend because it's still the comedy all comes from women playing with or against masculine tropes.
Oh.
And some ways in which it's really insidious, right? Like how I guess what I'm saying, the system still gets served. The patriarchy still gets served. It's a patriarchal kind of film. The tropes are patriarchal. And even the approach to them is patriarchal. For example, Mila Kunis, constantly referenced throughout it as turning 30 years of age. She has a bit of a crisis. I'm 30 now. I'm this. Yeah. Look, I was told there'd be no math. Mila Kunis is not 30, not by a long shot. Okay? That's fine. I have no problem with her playing a 30-year-old. I don't care, right? That I don't care. And she's beautiful and she's talented. And so, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. But this is the part that gets to me.
Okay.
Justin Theroux is her love interest. Justin Theroux is a man of 50. He's my age. Okay? So, we could have had the female lead, right, have a midlife crisis of being 40. We could have had her be, I'm in my late 30s, and I feel like I haven't accomplished anything, whatever. But, ooh, that really smacks me as distasteful that we needed to lie down her age so that she was an acceptable love interest for a 50-year-old man.
Ew. You think that's the case, or was it just...
Subtextually, I think it is. I mean, unconsciously, yeah.
Wow. That's so disappointing.
But it's but that's what I'm saying. It's unconscious. It's a patriarchy. All of these things are ingrained. They're enculturated. And so there is some humor to be had. I mean, I do like that they have a genuine friendship, Mila Kunis's character and Kate McKinnon's character. They play roommates, and they really do have quite a refreshing female friendship and bond in it, and a trusting, one of unwavering trust and honesty with each other. How often do you get to see that, especially from women on screen? That's cool. Again, it's all in a context of male fantasy.
Yeah.
And in service of supporting that male fantasy, right? If you service the system ultimately will win. And I also did find it a little refreshing in that it was nice that Kate McKinnon did play a character. And because she has been really a sticking point for me in previous movies where she just refuses to act.
Well, I don't know. Okay. Well, refuses to embody a character other than a persona.
Yeah.
Would you say?
Yeah. I mean, she's bringing her sketch work to bear. And it might just be that, you know, I mean, her training is different, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I find I can't watch SNL for the last 25 years because it's all charming personas. Nobody's really, even their characters are kind of just drywall fascia over their own persona still.
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be acting and sketch comedy don't have to be that kind of character work don't have to be mutually exclusive, but they are often different skill sets. There's no question about that.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that you can't be excellent at both, obviously.
That's right.
So it's nice to see her, you know, acting, I guess, is what I want to say. Oh, maybe she can act. Is what I want to say. So anyway, just a really disheartening way to end season 12 of your Joe Park Hollywood Hour.
I know. You've bummed me out top to bottom now.
Okay.
But I am going to watch David Lynch, The Art Life.
Yeah, do that and go see Endgame. Let's report.
And go see Endgame.
We'll talk about that. Once I can see, I will see Endgame. I don't really...
That's right.
I'm staying away from the theaters because I just... I'm terrified of how awful the experience will be for me with my eyes.
Well, good luck then
on Friday.
Meeting this Friday.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I feel like this was all just kind of a rehearsal, this show.
Yeah. Really good. Let's get season 13 down.
Year 13 begins Lucky 13, Baker's Dozen, next week, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. By the way, I put up several more older shows on chilpackhollywood.com.
Good.
At this rate, within 5 years, they'll all be available again. But, you know, that's fine. Whatever. All right, people know how to find the show. We've gone so overtime rambling. I'm right. Phil Larinus. I'll talk to you next week.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.